From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. This hour, we're going to hear from a former Chief Justice on Georgia Supreme Court.
You know, I've been a judge a long time. I've been a judge most of my life, since my 20s. And so I try very hard in the public sphere not to jump into political battles. You know, I talk about civility. I talk about ethical things. I talk about morality things. But I think you have more power when you do what judges do, which is what judges are supposed to do, which is don't jump into the political battle of the time, because one side won't listen to you.
That's Judge Leah Ward Sears. She rose to the top of Georgia's judicial system, a system that still largely supported segregation when she was born in the 1950s. Her story is just ahead, but first, let's hear from you. Are you old enough to remember when racial segregation was the law of the land? Do you still see the same divisions playing out today at school or in your neighborhood? We always want to know what you're thinking. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. One of the first African-American elementary schools in Atlanta was recently slated for destruction. But after outcry, a piece of the structure was saved to become part of a new YMCA center in Vine City. This is just one fight in a perennial battle over historic preservation. A recent National Trust for Historic Preservation study says Atlanta has a teardown culture, worse than just about any other major city. I recently talked about this with Sheffield Hale, president of the Atlanta History Center, and with M. Tamanika Youngblood, president of Sweet Auburn Works.
Good morning.
So I've got to pick up on that line there, a teardown culture in Atlanta. I read it with some emphasis on purpose. So M. Tamanika, do you agree with that assessment?
Unfortunately, I do.
You do?
I do agree with that assessment. I think that, you know, Atlanta historically has been trying to present itself as this new shiny southern city on the hill. And in the process of being that, I think it has intentionally in some ways sought to rid itself of its history, some of which is not pleasant, I'll grant you that. But I do think that it has to do with this notion that we are new, we are different, and we are not wedded to or into the past.
Ridding itself of its history. At what price do you think?
Oh, I think it's a serious price because history defines who you are. And I think that we lose the opportunity to lift up that history and we're talking about historic fabric here because we're talking about preservation. So we're not just talking about the story of what happened, but the places that those things happened. And in the process of not addressing that, which is less pleasant, I will be the first to admit, we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and so we've also rid ourselves of the things that indicate how we've been able to overcome some of that negative history and come out on the other side. But it's unfortunate because there are other aspects of historic fabric beyond just the story they tell. It's also the feelings they engender in people, an old building, an historic church, a place where your grandparents, you know, worked to make a beautiful building that, you know, unfortunately you can't look to anymore because it's been demolished. And so it's sort of ripping up the fabric of our human experiences, and that's just unfortunate.
And Sheffield, what's your thought on that language, the idea of Atlanta being part of a teardown culture?
I think that's true, and I think it's for a lot of reasons. I think a lot of it is economic, and it's we're a developer city oriented city, and people.
What does that mean to be a developer oriented city?
So if you're a developer, you're looking at an address or a piece of property, and you're not looking at what's on it. You're looking at where it is. And it's a lot easier in many cases to just tear it down and start over, and you have a new vision for it than to think about what it can become,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, the default, which should be, what do we have? How can we make it better? And so that's been sort of, that's been the culture that we've lived with for, you know, decades.
That was my next question. How long has this been a problem? I mean, how you go back, how far in charting the rise of this development culture in the city?
Well, I think it goes all the way back to the founding. The founding of the city. And Atlanta has been a rapidly growing city. And unlike some cities, say Charleston, Savannah, we haven't had the luxury of being economically dormant. And so one of the things that's what's happened is that we've actually been a vibrant city for most of our life. And so there was not a way to warehouse buildings or to, you know, and for people to stand back and say, wow, you know, this is something special. It was more in the moment.
Right.
And so you've got a Savannah or a Charleston or some of the other cities where things, economics, you know, were less robust. Things were able to be warehoused till people figure out what they had.
Right.
And so it's all of those things.
You know, it seems to me that there is this kind of inherent and unavoidable kind of push-pull when it comes to preservation and development. We talked about that issue with historian Karshik Sims Alvarado, and here's what she had to say.
Atlanta has a history of reinventing itself, and I think that's the thing that makes it unique. That spirit is also reflected in its architecture as well, too. While that is a positive, Atlanta and many other cities don't see the economic and cultural value and benefit of actually promoting preservation within the city.
And Sheffield, I guess to your point, but Tamanika, how do you get a city that seems to really be interested in what's next to appreciate its history and really its place in the world?
That's a really tough question. I wish I knew the answer to it. I might have started working on it a while back. I think that it's a matter of awareness and education. But I want to get back to something that Sheffield said. You know, I think that, yes, it's about economics, but, you know, I mean, there are developers in New York City and in Chicago and in Washington, D.C., and cities all across the country who have figured out that at some point it's really important to integrate the new into the old. And I think we are the poster child for not preserving because we just haven't done that, you know, economics aside. And I really do think it's about the new and reinvention and all that. But I think to address how we can get out of this, I mean, part of what we need to do, and it takes leadership. I think leadership really matters in almost anything you do, to really help Atlantans and to kind of guide the development community to understand, you know, what's possible and to appreciate where we came from. I mean, historically, you know, who you are is what creates who you are. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that we are special really is in many ways wedded to who we were and what we did and how we've ended up where we are. So it's about a sense of place. And so it's great to have a downtown or a place with a lot of new buildings and everything looks fine, but what's different or special? What story do you tell about
your narrative
yourself?
As a city? Yeah, yeah.
What is your narrative as a city? That's very
so give me a couple of examples, M. Tamanika first and then Sheffield, of sometimes you don't know what you've lost. You don't know what you don't know. So give me a sense of a couple of developments or a couple of buildings that you feel should still be here because they represent that rich tapestry of history here in Atlanta.
God, where do we begin? Okay, I mean, I'll go way back. I mean, Atlanta had two train stations, not just one, two. Gorgeous, you know, I mean, when folks built train stations in the day, they built them as iconic, beautiful
ornate
structures,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We tore both of ours down. And when you think about Union Station in D.C. and, you know, Penn Station, I mean, you think about the stations that other cities have recognized as of value, not just because they're beautiful, but because of when you think about what they represented to the city in terms of its commerce and the importance of it being a nexus for mobility for people. I mean, there are lots of aspects and ways to look at it. So so we had two, mm-hmm. not just one, two, and we tore them both down. And then, you know, I think about I'm working really hard in Sweet Auburn to preserve what's left of that historic fabric. We've lost a lot of it, and such that we are teetering between even remaining an historic landmark district.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, we were that happened when an entire block was torn down some years ago, and it's irreplaceable. And what comes back, you know, tells no story. You know, it's not revelatory. It doesn't reveal who we are and what we did and what we overcame and what we continue to need to do. And so there's that. And then I'll close my remarks with saying, think about the fact that we had to have a campaign to save the fox. You know, I mean, think about how hard people had to work.
That's kind of shocking
save,
to me. Yeah.
To save the fox. So, you know, there. I mean, and I'll let Sheffield talk because I'm sure there are lots of buildings.
Yeah. Sheffield.
There's so many that are gone, and M. Tamanika picked up on the key ones, and the Fox was a real turning point in the city in many ways. But let me pivot a little bit to what we've saved, okay, and how that is, you know, reflective of what's gone. So I remember people saying, well, we need to tear down the Biltmore Hotel. It's an eyesore. We need to tear down the Fulton Bag and Cotton Mill. It's an eyesore. Pont City Market. It's a white elephant.
That's right.
What are we going to do with it? Look what's happened now because of some visionary people. And they've also figured out that's what people want. If you look at the rents that they're able to extract now in Pont City Market for retail, that tells you something. Then if you look at all of the warehouses around town that have been converted into lofts, and we're at such a point that we're running out of product because we've torn down so much,
right.
We're having to create faux lofts because people want them so badly.
Yeah.
So that's
the good
think
news.
Of it that way. And the other piece on preservation is it's not just the historic piece; it's the urban development and what people want in terms of walkable cities.
Yes.
And the type of construction that is oriented to people.
And Sheffield, thank you. Sheffield Hale is the president of the Atlanta History Center. And M. Tamanika Youngblood is the president of Sweet Auburn Works. Thank you both. Thank you both. We'll be talking about this for days, weeks, and years to come. Thank you both. Just ahead, does race dictate where you go to school in Georgia? But first, a former Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court looks ahead. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Leah Ward Sears was the first African-American female Chief Justice in the United States. She served as Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court from 2005 to 2009. An upcoming biography documents her story from growing up in Savannah to the state Supreme Court. Leah Ward Sears joined me in the studio earlier this month. Your Honor.
Thank you.
Justice.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can we dive into the deep end of the
sure,
pool
go,
here, right off
go,
the top here?
I'll try not to drown.
No, okay, you won't. You won't. Look, your work has been about resolving conflicts.
Right.
That's your work. That's your life work. I don't want to be a prisoner of the present moment. The nation, I need to remind myself, fought a civil war. There was the fight for civil rights in this country. But I need you to put this current moment of polarization
and civility into context. Can you do that for us?
I will try. Let me give it to you like this.
Yeah.
The day after President Trump was elected, I have a daughter who's a millennial. She's 30 years old. She called me in tears. She was not really a big Hillary supporter, but definitely not a Trump supporter. And she was, at 30 years old, she was upset about the incivility in this country. How could this be? How could we be so divided?
Specifically what? What was troubling her?
Well, I mean, some of the comments that a man who had made comments off on that Access Hollywood tape, and some of the comments that had been made, and the terrible tone that the election took overall. She asked, how could this be? And my first reaction to her was, look, Brennan, you're 30, but I'm 62. So I was born in 1955. I lived through the civil rights movement. I lived through the women's rights movement. I lived through a time in Savannah when I'd get up every morning and there was this fellow named J.B. Stoner. He was a racist from Cobb County, I thought. I think he was. He would had an ad every morning saying, you nigger this, you nigger that, you nigger that. And I remember how my mother would get so upset, she'd call the radio station or TV station and say, get that man off the air. My children are trying to eat so they can go to school. This is nothing new in this. That's what I was telling her, is this is just another bump in the road. And I do believe that we will, as a nation, get through this period if people of goodwill work to get us through this period, and we'll be fine.
I notice
it's a bad period, though.
I notice in referencing the Access Hollywood tape, you mentioned the man. You didn't mention Donald Trump by name.
I try. Well, you know,
is there a reason for that?
Well, I have been long. You know, I've been a judge a long time. I've been a judge most of my life, since my 20s, and so I try very hard in the public sphere, not to jump into political battles. You know, I talk about civility. I talk about ethical things. I talk about morality things. But I think you have more power when you do what judges do, which is what judges are supposed to do, which is don't jump into the political battle of the time, because one side won't listen to you.
But Justice Sears... Oh, I want to get to that point in just a moment. But Justice Sears, look, everyone is asking you, I'm sure, friends, colleagues, acquaintances, folks you meet in your day-to-day are asking you to explain from your point of view, hey, can you explain how it is Donald Trump won the election and is the 45th president of the United States? What do you say to people?
I can't explain that.
You really can't?
No, I can't. Let me try.
Thank you.
Okay. I think that there is a deep upset and distrust among many, many Americans of the political status quo. And I don't think it all boils down to racism, although I think there's a good chunk of it there.
On a percentage basis, how much of it is racism?
Maybe 50-50.
You think it's 50-50?
I think it's a lot of racism.
And a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of racism. And it's racial views unexpressed or unexplored. You know, people don't really sometimes, when they're afraid or when they're angry, they don't know from whence it comes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is fear of what they don't understand. But I think a lot of it is economics, of the fear that I won't get enough, and others are taking mine, be it blacks
people
or
of color.
People of color or immigrants, you know, coming to this country. But I believe I know some Trump supporters who won't tell me they're Trump supporters,
okay,
which is an issue right there, but who I don't believe are... I don't believe are all that racist. I can't say there's no racism there. I think everybody has something about the other group that you have to deal with.
So I sort of compartmentalized our interview here.
Yes.
And this section is, I just called it bringing up baby. Bringing as a child, your life as a child. You're quoted in the book saying, one of the defining features of my upbringing has been race. Here's the quote. In my very, very early years, race was not an issue. I didn't know I was any different from all the kids that I grew up with.
Right.
They were all white. I just thought I was like everyone else. I was brown and they were not as brown.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
So talk about race as a defining issue in your life.
No, I thought, I grew up, I was born on a military base in Germany. My father was an army officer. So, and the army at that time was very segregated, not by race, but by class or rank.
Yeah.
Okay. So we lived in the officers' area, played with the officers' kids, and didn't mix much with NCOs and others. So I thought, and the other thing, just looking at my two parents, let me just break it down.
Yeah.
My father, have you seen the book?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I look at it? Because I haven't.
Well, I left it upstairs, but I have it, and I've read 90% of it.
I have not.
Oh, you haven't?
I haven't.
And explain that very quickly.
Okay, because I don't want to look back. I have a hard time looking back at me. Okay, I like other people to, and it's more truthful. But I will read, and I've looked through the manuscript. But if you've seen the book, you'll note that my father is a very dark skin
yes.
African-American man, and my mother is a very light-skinned African-American woman. So, you know, without asking a lot of questions, I just thought that some people, that race was, skin color was like eye color.
Right.
That some people were dark-skinned. I mean, is that so stupid?
No, of course not.
And that some people were light-skinned, and I was in the middle, brown skin. And
right.
so that was that. But I do remember very playing with these kids, running. These were the days where your parents would let you run out.
Oh, those days.
You were free, and my father would then stand on the corner, and he had this whistle, and we knew it was my father, and we'd all come running.
So you've given me a perfect moment to tell everyone about the book and to reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with former Georgia Supreme Court Justice Leah Ward Sears, Supreme Court Chief Justice. Wow. Her new biography is called Seizing Serendipity by Rebecca Davis. Do you remember the first time you were called a nigger?
Yeah, I was playing out in the woods on the post, the army post, and this kid turned around. I was old enough to be outside playing, and he said, those niggers. And I thought, oh, damn, this doesn't sound good. And I also remember when we came to the United States on a ship. Yeah. There's a picture in the book on us coming to the United States. My mother is holding me and my brother's there. And we rented a car or got a car. I don't know if they were. And we drove through New York City. And I noticed that the city was segregated, that black people were in one part and white people. And I was in the back seat and I said to my parents, what's going on? Don't you notice that the black people are on one side of the city and the white people. And I remember, you know, this is when the father drove and the mother sat on the, and they looked at each other and there was this knowing look like, oh Lordy, we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
We had not been exposed to that. And I was like 6 or 7 by then.
How old were you when the family moved to Savannah?
Junior high. It was called junior high school, so 12 or 13.
Now it's middle school or something, right?
It's middle school.
Right.
Yeah, but at the time.
I remember those junior high school days.
Yeah, it was like, so that would be 12 or 13.
So I can't let you go without having you reflect on your years growing up in Savannah. What do you remember about those years?
I liked Savannah. My father liked Savannah. I actually felt more comfortable in Savannah. I loved Atlanta. I jumped on a train with a friend of mine, lied to my parents. Shouldn't have done that, but jumped on.
That's a really good story in the book, by the way.
Yeah, called the Nancy Hanks. Told my father we were coming up to do one thing, and we went to Rich's department store. And I'd never seen anything like it, and I fell in love with Atlanta.
Yeah.
So.
Let's bring it forward.
Yes.
Was Ambassador Andy Young the first person to put the idea of becoming a judge in your mind?
Or
was
this someone? Yeah, my goal was to be Thurgood Marshall.
Okay? Really?
Yeah, I was going to.
From what age?
From as long as I could remember. Like, see, I just followed the Warren Burger Court, Thurgood Marshall. I knew who Brennan, Justice Brennan, my daughter, I named my daughter Brennan after William Brennan.
No kidding. Okay.
I could name her Thurgood, seriously. Okay, but so I named my daughter Brennan, and I followed from the earliest. So I was going to be a civil rights lawyer and change the law. I was going to change
these
big cases.
I see.
You know, now you get your. But the problem is, I was born too late. You know, Thurgood Marshall, it had already been done.
Yeah.
So by the time I got to Atlanta and I met Ambassador Young, his goal was to put African Americans on the benches. There were very few when he became mayor. Maybe four in the state, on the whole state superior court system. And he said what he was going to do is pick young women and men, but young women, and groom them. And that's what he did.
And obviously the rise is extraordinary from that point on. Why did then Democratic Governor Zell Miller appoint you to the Georgia Supreme Court? This was in 1992.
Right.
You were 36 years old.
Right.
Here's the real question I would ask you. Were you selected for the color of your skin and the content of your character?
I think both. And I think my intelligence.
Of course.
From what I heard from his executive assistant, because I think he had someone else in mind. I'm sure he had. So I come walking in, and I knew he had someone else in mind. I wasn't going. But I told him I had this long list of historical characters who had done things at young age, that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Our men fight it. And it was men at the time.
Yes.
At 18 and blah, blah, blah. And when I left, his executive counsel assistant said she said I was feisty. And I also remember offering him advice on how to settle a lawsuit. I just didn't have, I just didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that.
Justice Leah Ward Sears is here. Were you convinced that you were up for the job? Was there a part of you that thought, I'm maybe a bit in over my head with this job?
Well, when I applied, I knew I wasn't getting the job.
Okay.
Now, But when he called, when Zell Miller called, Governor Miller called, I was speechless. And people started gathering around the walls of my chambers. And they thought that I had been appointed to a seat. There was an open seat on the Court of Appeals at that time. And they thought I had gotten that seat. And at a certain point in the conversation, I looked up and I said to the people who were trying to be quiet, because I'm talking to the governor, I said, he put me on the Supreme Court. And they went, wow, you know, and all that. So he knew I had a crowd there. I did think. Let me say this. I did think, whoa, this is going to be tough. But I knew I was driving around 285 on my way to work. And this pop thing came into my head that God doesn't give you more than you can chew. Now, you're going to get in there and you're going to do everything that you need to do to be a success, because you have people riding on it and you will not fail. And God did not put you there to fail, so you just go on and do it.
Your reaction to what I'm about to play for you. Ready? Let's roll clip one.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin.
Johnny Mathis.
Yes.
What did he mean to you growing up?
Is this in the book?
Yes, it's
really?
In the book.
Okay, I got to read. Well, I was visiting my aunt in San Diego. I got to study.
Now, I don't have much time,
okay,
but I need
I was visiting my aunt in San Diego, and we were just, this is 1968, and we were just swooning. She had just had a baby, and I remember my Aunt Jewel saying, you know, he goes to the other side or something like that, some old thing. And I was like, what do you mean? And this was the first time I realized that some people were gay, and I was 13. I had never known that.
And that's all the time I have.
Okay, good enough.
This is so wonderful. Okay. I could go on for another hour easily. Leah Ward Sears, jurist and former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Georgia. A biography about her life called Seizing Serendipity will be published by the University of Georgia Press in September. Leah Ward Sears, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You really did read this book.
Yes.
Okay.
Just ahead, how segregation persists in Southern schools. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we talk about the Allman Brothers at the big house in Macon. Greg Allman passed away earlier this year. If his music touched your life, we want to hear about it. What's your favorite Allman Brothers song or memory? You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave us a message. You can also let us know on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the program. The U.S. Supreme Court issued its historic ruling Brown versus the Board of Education more than six decades ago. For the first time, it became illegal to separate public school students by race. But according to a recent report from the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, many public schools in the South have resegregated in those years since that decision. The study also found Latino student enrollment surpassed Black enrollment for the very first time. We talked about the state of Southern schools earlier this month with three guests. Erica Frankenberg worked on the report, and she's an associate professor of education at Penn State University. Erica, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Also with us is Belisa Urbina. She is executive director of Ser Familia. Her organization provides counseling and other services to Hispanic families in the metro Atlanta area. Belisa, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joining me on the line is Atlanta Journal-Constitution education reporter Maureen Downey. Maureen, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Erica, let me start with another line or two from the report. In 2014, more than one in three Black students in the South, that's 35.8%, attended a school that was intensely racially segregated, meaning 90% of students were non-white. That is a 12.8% increase from 23% in 1980. Was that finding surprising to you in any way?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really important to think about with regard to that finding is that the South historically, because of the efforts it made after Brown v. Board of Education, had that really low percentage of Black students in these segregated minority schools. Mm. And so for several decades, actually, the South had the lowest percentage of Black students in such schools. As a native of the region in other areas of the country, I like to make that point. Right. When we work together to make this happen through a variety of court orders and other political efforts, we brought about tremendous change. You know, most people like to think of segregation as a Southern issue, and actually Black students were the most integrated. What's unfortunate is that in the last decade or two decades, we've seen an unraveling of the progress that was made. And so we have seen that increase for Black students in the South. It's still lower than Latino students in the region for a variety of reasons, but it's concerning that the advantages the South had no longer exist.
And Maureen, what does your reporting tell you about this resegregation in Georgia?
Well, it's been happening for quite a while in the South, and what it mimics is residential segregation in the South. We now have very segregated neighborhoods, white folks living in one area, North Fulton, for example, and Black residents in South Fulton, the same for DeKalb County. So what we have here is people who are choosing to live in certain areas, and the schools then follow. And the question that I've raised in my reporting is people are choosing to segregate in some respects by choice. And I've talked to both Black and white parents who question, the value of putting their kids on a bus and taking them across town to attend a school that is more diverse. So I think the challenge here is that I'm not sure parents are as committed to this ideal as they once were.
Yeah. Belisa, what are you finding in working with Latino families?
We have been working with Latino families for the last 17 years. And what I have seen, you know, in the last, I will have to say, 6-7 years, is that Latino students tend to be more concentrated in certain schools.
Do Latino families see this as a problem?
Not necessarily. They don't. I don't think they see it as a problem unless, you know, you go to the fact that most of these schools have less opportunities for the students than other regular schools.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the education reporter, her name is Nicole Hannah-Jones, for the New York Times Magazine, writes, the inequality we see, school segregation, is both structural, systemic, but it is also upheld by individual choices, which cuts to the point you were just making, Maureen.
Yeah, I think that's a good point here, and I don't really know how to go to deal with that point, frankly, because, you know, you go out and you talk to parents, and they value diversity. They don't. It's not that they dismiss it, but they like their neighborhood schools, and they also simply feel like they're entitled to the school down the street from them. That's one reason why they, you know, move to Roswell, or why they move to Decatur, or why they move to, you know, certain neighborhoods in Gwinnett County. So it's very difficult politically to come in and say, yes, you live down the street from the school, and you think it's a great school, but we prefer that your kid go to a school 3 miles down the road, and one of their, you know, major factors is increasing diversity. Yeah. That is not a good sales job for parents anymore.
Right. Erica, does this idea of this kind of segregation that's highlighted in your report, does it necessarily mean inequality in education when it comes to the quality of principals, technology, and so on and so forth?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that we've continued to study this issue. For example, we find in the South that the typical Black and Latino student is exposed or goes to school that's about 2/3 composed of students from low-income families. The typical white student goes to school that has 20% percentage point less low-income students. That matters for a variety of different reasons, including the exposure to educational opportunity that one of your guests already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so the premise of the Brown decision was that segregated schools were inherently unequal for Black students. There was also something in the social science record that was submitted to the court that talked about how white students who were in segregated white schools in these areas that were challenged had this unfair sense of superiority. So there are a range of different ways of thinking about why integrated schools matter. And I think it's really important to think both about the harms of segregated schools, but also the benefits of integrated schools that students of all races, both Black and Latino students, but also white students, benefit from. And I think it's also important to because we've shifted the way we think about public schools, we've kind of gotten away from thinking about some of those benefits. We've translated schools to thinking about it as much more of a private good, that it's something that parents can buy in terms of where they buy a house. Of course, that overlooks the segregation in the housing market that still affect Black and Latino mm-hmm. affluent families even. But we think about it as a private good. It's what I want for my kid, instead of thinking about public schools as educating our community's children. And so when we shift in thinking about schools from this public good to more of a private good, it helps us in some ways to be comfortable and okay with the fact that we have segregation and that some students are going to schools that don't have the same kind of opportunities, which is profoundly against sort of what we believe public schools to be about originally.
So interesting. Belisa, I'm wondering, with the families that you talk to and work with, do they see their schools where there is this high concentration of other Latinos from their neighborhood? Do they see those schools as being equal in terms of education, in terms of teachers, as predominantly white schools?
Not in all neighborhoods. You know, you have schools that have predominantly Latino students in some neighborhoods that you can see, and parents tell you that they are lacking the opportunities for the children. You know, the sporting facilities are not as good. They don't have the same quality of teachers. They don't have the same opportunities for the kids. So they notice. They know.
Yeah. A bit more from the report now, Erica. It is clear that the region is now moving backward in terms of the progress it made in desegregating schools. In fact, some states have recently created overtly racist policy proposals and rhetoric that simply ignores the reality that the region's future depends on developing the talents of people who live there and are the fastest growing segment of the population. Now, what states are we talking about here that are engaging in racist policy proposals, Erica?
So certainly one of the states that we can think about is my native state of Alabama. And in fact, in 2010 or 2011, they passed one of the most restrictive laws against immigration in the country that had a really damaging effect on the opportunity for Latino students who were scared even in some instances to go to school. Principals were reporting a drastic increase in absenteeism because of concerns about what was going to happen with their family. Also, some issues in terms of even schools requiring certain information from families that would have potentially revealed documentation status. All of these policies, many of these policies were blocked by the federal courts, so they're not in place. But even passing such laws, I think, sends a real chilling effect to families and communities that you're not welcome. And schools in particular, that goes against fundamentally the kind of trusting environment that you're trying to create to be welcoming to all families so that everyone is engaged collaboratively in the educational environment. So, you know, that's certainly one example. We also know in many states in the South, and we talk about this in our report, that there are other policies that are really going to be challenging to integration moving forward. Certainly, there are places in the South that are creating these new school districts, like certainly the Gardendale case in metropolitan Birmingham has been a real flashpoint lately. The creation of that white enclave and the way in which that then creates district boundary lines that are going to impede desegregation
efforts.
These
are sort of breakaway communities, correct?
Exactly. Splinter. You can even call them, to some extent, seceding from a larger, more diverse school district because we typically don't let students cross boundary lines to go to school. That has a real huge impact in terms of the overall segregation we're seeing in our metropolitan areas across the country and is a growing issue in the South. There was just a recent report that said most of the new creation of school districts in this splinter-like format are occurring in the South. So that's a really big issue that is chipping away at another advantage the South had, which was having a lot of countywide districts that enabled more diversity because you had both communities of color and white communities in the same district and at least had different opportunities for student assignment that you don't have when they're in different school districts.
We're talking about school resegregation in the South. Our guest, Erica Frankenberg, she's a professor at Penn State University. Maureen Downey is with us. She writes for the Get Schooled blog on the AJC, and Belisa Urbina is with us, executive director of Ser Familia Incorporated. Maureen, do we see this? Do we see breakaway communities developing in Georgia?
Oh, we don't, because our Constitution won't allow it. Won't allow these new school districts, and that was, you know, essentially passed to prevent exactly what Erica described. Now, there has been effort in the legislature to undo that. It has not happened yet. What we're seeing in Atlanta, in the state as a whole, is we're seeing certainly growth in charter schools.
Yes.
And their report notes, Erica's report notes, that that's causing segregated schools also, because so many of the charter schools are predominantly minority. I have to tell you, parents would probably not care about that because they believe the charter schools are giving their child a better education. So whether or not their child sits next to a white student or an Asian student or an Hispanic student is not critical to them when they make that choice. But I think what we're seeing here is the residential pattern is leading to clearly schools that are increasingly either all African American or all white, and politicians simply do not want to wade into that. Frankly, they simply don't want to tell parents. And we, in fact, are a state that is, I think, you know, to some degree, embracing the notion that school is a private choice, a private good, and that parents should decide that. And there's no one in the policy level who should unravel a parent decision or challenge a parent decision on these other issues, including diversity. And I think that's the direction the country is going in, so I am not optimistic that diversity will win out.
Wow. Belisa, what are your thoughts on the impact of charter schools on Latino families?
Many Latino families are choosing charter school because of the same issues that we just talked about, that they believe it's better education for the kids. But my concern about our Latino kids to be entrenched, if we could call it that way, in a specific area or a specific school, is that there is already a sense of fear and distrust in the community. So just segregating our Latino children into specific schools in which they only have contact with other Latino students is not going to help. And if we take into account that Latino students as a group, they are growing more in our schools, are, you know, a greater percentage and greater numbers than any other demographic group, then, you know, it's not a Latino problem anymore. It's a problem of our community, and we need to help these kids to be integrated and to feel that they are part of the community as a whole.
Let's hear from Gavin Sams. He is the founder of the Genesis Innovation Academy. That's a new charter school opening this fall in Southeast Atlanta. He says charter schools should reflect the diversity of the surrounding community.
For people to be involved would be helpful, because if you're in the community and you see a school coming that doesn't attempt to reach out to the broader community or doesn't want to diversify, then yes, the public should speak out. But certainly there are schools that are started in other areas and they're going to reflect the diversity of their area. I sort of feel like there should be probably some mandate to push that in that direction.
You know, Erica, I'm wondering, if I suggest to you the report won't lead to much soul searching on this issue, because history tells us there's always been massive even resistance to ending school segregation. How do you respond to that?
I think to be in this line of work, I have to disagree with you. And I'll just cite a couple of reasons. First, we've seen actually a few years ago, the Civil Rights Project released a report showing that New York State was the most segregated state in the country. That went against everything that progressive New Yorkers believed about themselves. And as a result, actually, in the next few months, the State Board of Education in New York is going to consider adopting a wide-ranging integration plan to provide state incentives and financial funding to local districts to help them with integration efforts. So that's just one recent example of the way in which, you know, a report like this got under the skin of folks and really made them do the soul searching that you talked about. The second is that I'd like to just point out again that the South actually did something about it. And granted, some of them did it very resistantly. This, certainly the district I grew up in, did not want to desegregate initially. But a lot of school districts in the South, because of the long legacy of integration, have voluntarily continued to create integration policies. This doesn't mean forced busing the way we might think it is.
Right.
It's using choice with civil rights policies, which is different than, say, charter schools that often don't have civil rights policies, to try to create more integrated schools. Those are wildly popular schools, by and large, for example, magnet schools and the like.
Sure.
And so we see a lot of communities really doing a lot to try to further integration right now because of the benefits for all students.
That's Penn State University Professor Erica Frankenberg. You also heard AJC reporter Maureen Downey and Belisa Urbina of the group Ser Familia. And that's our show for today, but we always want to hear from you. Do your kids go to a diverse school? Why or why not? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Have a great day.